Welcome to episode number 16 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
That's right. And joining us today is video game historian Liam Robertson. In addition to his own independent work, Liam has a series on the Did You Know Gaming channel called Game History Secrets. His latest video in the series, Work Boy, Lost Game Boy Add-on Found After 28 Years, looks at a little-known piece of Game Boy history. Liam, welcome to the Video Game History Hour.
Thank you very much for bringing me on. This is going to be fun.
So, just to start us off on the right track, what was the Work Boy?
Ooh, well, it was a PDA-style add-on, a keyboard add-on peripheral for the original Game Boy. And you plug it in, and you can do stuff like look at a calendar. You've got a phone book in it. You can convert measurements and stuff like that. It's sort of a basic kind of, you know, the type of functions you'd have nowadays in a smartphone. But, 20 years ago, well, actually 30 years ago, come to think about it. And, it was quite ahead of its time in a lot of respects. But, it was cancelled about 30 years ago, a couple of years into the original Game Boy's lifespan. And I tried to hunt one down.
So before you sort of set off on this journey to track one down, we did know some basic things about it, right? There was press coverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it appeared at CES, I think in 1992, and it was expected to be released around the end of that year, early 93. And I think that's its only public appearance. I could be wrong, but that was the only record I could find of it. And it was covered by a few different outlets, like the Nintendo Power, of course, talked about it, and a couple of UK-based magazines like Game Zone. And it even appeared in a piece by the Chicago Tribune and a couple of different newspaper outlets. But it was relatively obscure because it did only have that one public appearance from what I'm aware of. And yeah, there was a prototype there, if I remember correctly, and a couple of different people were shown it. I don't think there's any video of it from CES, although I've been told like there's images of it out there, you know, of this prototype set up and running, and different outlets got to see a hands-off demonstration, from what I understand. But that was the extent of the coverage before it was canceled, I think.
And it got this huge spread in Nintendo Power, like a full spread that, to me, I found that really interesting because it really seemed like it was kind of focused more on an adult consumer, maybe. I mean, you mentioned smartphones right away, which I think is great because I love that tangent that, you know, before we had smartphones, you just look for whatever the easiest application of bringing this to people is. And, you know, building your own electronics is difficult, but what if you just use the electronics that people already have, like a Game Boy? So, mm-hmm. I mean, this really is kind of like it seems more like an adult productivity software for the electronic computer they already had, might have already had in their pockets, or at least they could swipe from their kids.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I feel like they were more targeting kids myself, at least from what the developers said. But I agree with you. There was some potential there at the time, because this was back when, you know, as I say in the video, computers were still relatively financially prohibitive, and you had the Game Boy. And if you can create some kind of productivity add-on for that, then it could be a lot cheaper than an actual like computer or something like that at the time. And yeah, this was before smartphones, so it could have been a less expensive alternative. And I think it's definitely novel, at least, to have something like this on the original Game Boy with a keyboard and everything. But yeah, I feel like they were mostly targeting I guess, slightly grown-up kids, from what I can recall. If I remember correctly, Frank Ballou, who's in charge of FabTech, the company that produced it, he said that they were thinking about sort of, I guess, maybe slightly out of touch parents and grandparents who were like, oh, we've bought the kids enough games. Let's buy them something useful. You know, let's buy them something that they can do something. They can do something productive on this. You know, this is good for them. It's got a calculator. They can do maths on it.
Yeah. And I mean, I actually wrote down that quote because I thought that was so interesting, and it kind of goes contrary to everything I initially believed about this item. You know, I mean, I don't, other than it being a Nintendo Power, which already felt like kind of a weird stretch to me, I didn't see how a child could ever be interested in something like this. So for him to say that, you know, this was for kids, this was for, you know, parents to buy for children, I was like, what, really? That was your strategy with this? That's crazy.
Well, that was literally every console in the early 80s, though, right? Like, every one of them had some sort of computer add-on or was morphed into, you know, with the ColecoVision, morphed into the Atom or whatever. There was just this scam, you know, for a good decade on and off of companies believing that the video game console had a higher purpose, right? or at least could trick parents into thinking that video game consoles could have a higher purpose. And in fact, I'd even extend that into things like the CDI and the 3DO in the mid-90s were still kind of doing that too.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Frank Ballou. I think it's worth mentioning, especially when we're talking about how there was this huge spread in Nintendo Power. You know, I suspect that placement and indeed the publishing agreement and the patents for the product itself, et cetera, probably had at least a little bit to do with Ballou's history with Nintendo.
Right. Yeah. I did try to press him on that because you're right. He worked as an executive at Nintendo back when they were, you know, doing arcade machines. And he left around when they stopped in about 86, around about then, and he started his own company. And yeah, I get the impression that there was a kind of an understanding, maybe it's a bit of an unspoken understanding, you know, that they were good friends. Frank was good friends with Arakawa. He's told me on numerous occasions, and I've spoken to different people who said, oh yeah, Frank was the guy who could get you an in with Arakawa, even though he didn't directly work with him for most of the time. So yeah, I did ask him, like, what was the arrangement there? And he was quite insistent. Oh no, they didn't do me any special favors, you know, but he did say that his projects would sometimes get, you know, kind of bumped up in the pecking order, in the pipeline, if you will, if he had something that he needed doing, you know, if he needed Nintendo to take a look at something for whatever reason, for certification or something, or for testing, they would prioritize his work sometimes, he'd say. But I get the impression in general Nintendo was relatively impartial. But yeah, he definitely did have an in there.
So he's, in your video, he's not really, you know, the only person you ended up talking to. And in fact, I think Ballou himself would say that really the brains, and the soul maybe behind the work boy would be Eddie Gill, right? Can you tell us about Eddie?
Yeah, Eddie Gill is an incredibly smart man. He was the founder of a company called Source R&D, which was based in England in the 80s. And I think it's functioned for about 10 years. I'm not exactly sure, because he has worked at quite a few different companies that he's been in charge of. But yeah, Eddie, the Workboy was his idea, was to, I guess it was something that he had the idea for it, and Frank presented the means through which it could be created. But yeah, he wanted to do some kind of productivity software. And then, you know, Frank had this in with Nintendo, and granted him the opportunity to pitch something and get that going with them. But yeah, I think Eddie just wanted to do something ambitious with a keyboard add-on for the Game Boy and, you know, draw upon what little power it had to create something that was, you know, genuinely useful and was multifunctional. And, you know, it's got all these different apps in it, you know, a phone book, calculator, a world map, a translator. I think Eddie was really into the idea of creating this Swiss Army knife of a gadget that people could use in lots of different ways. And yeah, I mentioned this in the video. It sort of went on to become the Nokia 9000 series of devices in many ways after it didn't come to fruition, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Eddie went and he took inspiration from the Workboy, his original idea to create his patent, which would become the Nokia 9000. And yeah, I think Eddie was very ahead of his time. You know, a lot of his ideas were very similar to what you have on a modern smartphone just years and years earlier. He was so ahead of his time, as Frank mentions in the video. And he's just an incredibly smart pioneer that I think is definitely underappreciated in his own right. This isn't the only thing he's shown me that he's worked on. And yeah, he was a smart guy with a lot of big ideas years before smartphones and what have you.
Well, and you even showed in the video something that I don't think anyone knew was even a concept. I mean, it never sounds like it never made it past the concept phase, but that he wanted to bring the Workboy concept back for the Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, I think he wanted to do, I guess, a series of Workboy devices. You know, the one that we show in the video was just the start. And I think had they made that one for the original Game Boy, you probably would have gotten one, depending on its success with each successive console. But he went to Nintendo in the late 90s, and that presented the opportunity to sort of rejig the idea of the Workboy, and he came up with what he called the Workboy 2. I imagine it wouldn't have been called that because there wasn't a Workboy 1 released, but yeah, he came up with this thing, and it was another keyboard add-on for the Game Boy Advance, with, you know, a couple more advanced features. Like, it was supposed to have internet browsing and email, and I'm not really sure how all that would have worked on something as primitive as a Game Boy, Game Boy Advance.
Mobile browser for the Game Boy and Game or Color and Game Boy Advance in Japan, but it connects to a Japanese cell phone. So my guess is it probably would have used cell phones to get that capability, but I mean, I didn't see any of that from just the images, so it's hard to say.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea, honestly. I didn't dig into it that far with him. I'm still eking information out of him as we speak, but it was another go at doing that, and he was working directly with Nintendo that time, and it just didn't move forward. I don't think Nintendo was interested, but the full story on that I've yet to get out of him. He's kind of tight-lipped about that one.
So, I mean, that's sort of jumping ahead a little bit, right, into the sort of legacy of the Workboy. But back to the Workboy itself, I mean, this is something that was developed to completion, right?
More or less, yeah. I think the software was at least done. We have this prototype, which I'm sure you'll mention at some point, and yeah, it looks relatively finished. I mean, it is a prototype. I'm not an expert on the hardware side of things, but it does seem like it was more or less at the finish line. It was ready to go, and it just had a couple more steps left, you know, like certification and what have you, and it was about to be released in 1992. And then at some point in the months before CES in sort of mid 92, and it was meant to be launched at this event in Birmingham, in England, in, I think, December 1992. And at some point between those dates, Frank as he put it, lost his gonads and decided not to do it. And I think the reason was because they were going to slash the price of the Game Boy, he was told, by Nintendo. And yeah, he realized that potentially the Work Boy could end up more expensive than the Game Boy itself. And at that point, it wouldn't be able to be priced competitively enough for it to succeed, which is fair enough. But he has told me that he does regret that to an extent, which I feel is really interesting. It's very rare that you talk to someone who's made something like this and they will look back on it and say, maybe we made the wrong call here. But that's what Frank says, that he just regrets not being able to see the legacy of this thing, you know, had it come out, would people still be talking about it and that sort of thing, you know, how far could it have really gone if he had taken a chance on it? I'm not sure myself. I think it might have been too niche, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because, I mean, you have to remember the Game Boy was like a $90 system, I think, at launch, right? It was never more than $100. And so to have an expensive peripheral like that is just, it's a hard sell. And I, as much as I would have loved to see this thing in the world, because I really love the idea of, you know, using the Game Boy as a computer for sort of a higher purpose, as Frank put it earlier. I think I tend to agree with his gut feeling that it would be a really hard sell to have a system or an accessory that cost as much or more than the thing you're buying it for. I mean, I can't even, other than like really, really high-end steering wheels for like the Xbox One or something like that, like I can't even think of accessories that are more expensive than the systems you buy them for.
Right, yeah. I think it would have definitely been restricted to just a niche of Game Boy players because, you know, it is an entertainment device. And these are the types of features that nowadays, you know, you expect for standard. And I feel like back then it wouldn't have been that much of a draw that, you know, people would be willing to spend, you know, like the same price of the system again to get these features, which, you know, are novel and are cool to play about with for a bit, but I don't think it's worth that price. Maybe I'm wrong there. Maybe it would have done really well, but I feel like, yeah, if they couldn't get the price down to at least less than the original Game Boy, then it would have been a problem for them.
So in your video, it just sort of comes up naturally that, oh my gosh, one of these still exists. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah, so when I was researching it, I was never, you know, out to get one. You know, I'd heard of the Work Boy, people had shown me it, and nobody had seen one in about 28 years. And I just wanted to see how far down the rabbit hole I could go. And I reached out to a couple of different people. Firstly, Eddie Gill was one of the first people I reached out to. And then he put me in touch with Frank Ballou. And Eddie had heard, I guess, whispers that there might be one or two prototypes left. And the way you discover that a prototype is left in the video is exactly how I discovered it. You know, there's no, I guess there is a bit of theatrics there. But that's really how it happened. You know, I'd heard from Eddie Gale that Frank Ballou might have one. And we were talking. And Frank, in the middle of our conversation, is just like, oh, yeah, and I've got the Work Boy behind me. And then he just changed the subject. he thought of it, I guess, as nothing. You know what I mean? Like, to him, that's just been sat there for years. It's this old thing that he worked on years ago. And he thinks nothing of it. And I'm sitting here like, I couldn't focus on what he was saying because I was just thinking, Work Boy, he has one. Oh my God, it's right there. He didn't have his camera on at that point, but I was just thinking, oh my God, it's right there. This guy has one, this thing that people have sought after for many years. And but he turned on his camera and he lifted it down off his shelf and there it was. And I mean, it was pretty shocking. You know, I didn't think it would be that simple to just ask him. Like, I was going to ask him at some point, do you have a work boy? Because typically, I don't think when you're doing an interview with someone and you want to ask them to do something for you, like say, hey, can you like send us some pictures of a prototype or whatever? That's something I would build up to. So I was going to ask him that last. And yeah, I just not even approached that subject when we were talking. And he just brought that up himself. And yeah, it was pretty shocking for him to do that.
And well, you know, you mentioned maybe asking him to take pictures or whatever, but he went a little further than that.
Yeah, I was very much not expecting that. You know, we spoke and then we hung up and I felt everything had went well. And he said, yeah, I'll send you some pictures. And it was originally just going to be pictures. But then I feel like Frank, maybe because he just didn't want to bother with like filming it and everything. All I asked for was pictures. And I said, can you get it working? And he says, oh, I don't have like an original Game Boy here. I've got a Game Boy Pocket, but it's not compatible with that. And so I was like, okay, well, I know a guy, he'll send you an original Game Boy. And I think as I was suggesting this, Frank was just like, Liam, why don't I just send it to you? You know, I feel like maybe I annoyed him into sending it to me. I don't know. Frank is a busy guy. Like it took me like 7 months of badgering him, of emailing him, Frank, can we talk, please, to get to that point. And so I feel like he realized how persistent I was and was just like, okay, Liam, I'm just going to send it to you. Is that okay? And I was like, I really did not expect that. You know, I was not intending to get the work boy from him because in my mind, this is his child. You know, I don't want to take his baby from him.
Well, I mean, he kept it on his bookshelf next to him.
It's true. It's true.
Followed him through moves and then continued to be at a prominent place in his house.
He,
yeah.
He put it in a place where when he's working, he wants it within eyesight.
Yeah,
because it works. It's the work boy. He needs it to work.
So I asked him, yeah, can I send you a Game Boy? And he'd not even tried it for years. But we were like, yeah, I bet this would work if we hooked it up somehow. And Frank told me that, you know, he thought if you just plug this into a Game Boy, it'll work. And I'm not a technical guy. I realize now that it is stupid to expect it to do that. That's not how the Game Boy works. I know that now.
I don't think you can read software through that port or anything.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. When I interview someone and they've worked on something, I don't want to say, no, Frank, you don't know what you're talking about.
I've seen a Game Boy or two.
Yeah. I know more about the work boy than you, Frank. So anyway, yeah. Bottom line was he volunteered to send me this Workboy prototype. I got it and I hooked up to a Game Boy and nothing happened. It was just beeping, you know, and I was like, why is it beeping? Is it broken? But that little sign of life that it was beeping at least showed me that it still works on some level. I did have to change the batteries. It did have like watch batteries in it from like the 1990s. So I took those out and replaced those.
Frank, no.
it didn't work at first. And do you want me to go on to explain how we got it working?
Yeah.
All right.
Because I mean, it's such a beautiful little cosmic coincidence.
It is a series of incredibly serendipitous events, and I was really awestruck constantly in the process of researching this. So anyway, I'll cut to the chase. We couldn't get this thing working. Eddie Gill, the guy who created the thing, told me, oh, you need a software cartridge. That's what'll get it working. And I was like, oh, great. Okay, well, I have the work boy now, and you know, I've got this thing in front of me, and it's amazing, but it doesn't work. And so now we've got to hunt for the software cartridge. And to me, you know, it was pretty anticlimactic. You know, we gotten this far after months of trying to get Frank to, you know, talk to me about the work boy. He'd sent me the thing and now we can't get it working. And so I just did what I do, and I talked to different developers who worked on it. Very hard to do that. Very hard to find people who actually worked on this thing, because the companies that made it weren't very big and what have you. And then in the background of all this was the Nintendo Giga Leak. Let me ask you a question here, a terminology question. Do you define the different leaks from the servers as Giga Leaks, or is the Giga Leak the first one that came out? What would you say?
Or is the Giga Leak an ongoing process, perhaps, right? Like, what is it?
I feel like it's a series of, I mean, it is, you know, in the literal sense, leaking out of probably what was one giant, you know, something that somebody still owns or doesn't own, obviously, but has access to and is eking out. So I guess that's my definition of it. Does that sound right to you, Frank?
Yeah, I mean, it almost seems like there are definitely like different quote unquote releases within the Giga Leak, right? So there's, you know, the October leaks, the September leaks,
right.
Yeah, I don't know. This is an odd place to go down.
But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
But if we were categorizing these right as archivists, are they individual artifacts? Each release, I don't know.
So anyway, yeah, you got the Giga Leak. I'm sure most people listening know what that is. Nintendo had their servers hacked by someone or some people over the past couple of years. And yeah, the contents of these servers have been leaking online periodically in these big dumps that some people call Giga Leaks or the Giga Leak, whatever. And every so often a new bout of data comes out. And when the first one came out, you know, you've got all this ancient history from the Nintendo archives, like unused sprites, full resolution, like sound files and stuff like that. And yeah, I'm sure you guys have spoken about this before. Like, it is very, stuff from Nintendo's past that we never expected to ever see again. Really, really rare stuff. And there was some third-party stuff in there as well. And I think seeing that got me to thinking, wow, if they've got that in there, could there potentially be the Workboy software in one of these dumps of data? And at the time, you know, I didn't want to rely upon that. I wanted to keep digging into it. Could we find the Workboy software on our own is what I wanted to try and do. But what ended up happening,
you didn't want to opt into the stolen property from Nintendo.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not above doing that, but you know, I would rather get it a more official way. You know, I'd rather talk to a developer and they'd be like, oh yeah, we've got this here. Here you go. But that didn't end up happening, because a few weeks after I got the Workboy hardware, another one of these dumps of data appeared online on 4chan or what have you. And people started downloading it, rummaging through it, and someone got in touch with me and they had found in it the Workboy software. And I woke up that day, and how I found out was I just searched through Twitter, like Workboy, because, you know, who else is going to be talking about the Workboy in 2020?
Yeah, most people that day were like, look, there were two other Austin Powers fake Windows OS game things.
know? Right.
Oh, I think the one I tweeted about was finally the Vanilla Ice game for the Game Boy.
Woohoo. I was searching through Twitter like for Workboy, and there were like one or two people who were like, oh my god, do you guys remember the Workboy? But in general, it didn't really blow up. And somebody sent me the file for the software, and I booted up I booted it up in an emulator and it kind of worked, but not really, because my understanding of it is, you know, raw emulation can't really do the job because this software was designed to work with this keyboard, which has its own form of memory in it. And it has a built-in clock and other such things to measure the time. So yeah, there's like a number of different gadgets inside the Workboy itself that it needs to function properly. So emulation on its own, I think some people have gotten it to work now in the months after, but when it first initially leaked online, people couldn't get the Workboy software to work. So
it was like just the calculator, right? And then everything else was just completely non-functional without the accessory.
Yeah, mostly because it needed the clock. But anyway, I burned it to a cartridge and I put it all together, and it was the moment of truth. And I was really afraid that it wasn't going to work, you know, because that's the moment of truth where it all is decided. Is any of this worth doing? You know, have I wasted all my time, like, digging this out? And, you know, the prototype, like, very well, very easily could not have worked. But when I put everything together and I turned it on, the beeping stopped out of the Workboy speaker. And I pressed the return key and I remember it lit up and it worked perfectly fine. And I remember being really surprised. You know, this thing just works faultlessly. You go through the menus super quick, and I was impressed, honestly, like how functional it was, not just for a prototype, but just for a piece of software from back then. It's faster than my old smartphone, to be honest, like in some respects anyway, like the way you can flick through the apps is so intuitive, and it does feel ahead of its time.
They hadn't invented planned obsolescence yet. So, you know, to see it in action and go through all the features and stuff, check out the video link in the podcast description. I don't really want to have a podcast where we describe things like using a calculator. but what I thought was kind of cool was that it seemed like Eddie Gill was really happy to see it working again.
Yeah, that was one of the interesting things about this whole thing, you know. Eddie, for whatever reason, the people of Source hadn't really archived their software, and he, I guess, you know, it was mostly a job to them, and so they'd moved on to other things. And, you know, I'm sure the two of you know this very well, that sometimes stuff just doesn't get backed up, and people move along to, you know, different hardware, and stuff becomes obsolete, and it becomes harder and harder to retain that work that you did so many years ago from these ancient file formats and what have you.
Well, especially like 92, right? Like this is a time of computers evolving very quickly. So I'm sure whatever they used for programming the Workboy, you know, was quickly closeted you know, given that the project was never even released, there probably wasn't an official, you know, backing up of its software at any point. You can easily see how something like this disappears if not for corporate theft.
Yeah, basically. So, yeah, as you said, Eddie was very happy to get this. I remember I spoke to him once we got the prototype, and he told me, you're going to need the software to play on it. And he said to me, I remember, I don't think you're going to be able to find this thing. You know, he was like, you'll be very, very lucky if you find this software, Liam. And I was keenly aware of that as I started to search for it. And then one day it did bring me a lot of joy to be able to say, hey, we found your lost work. It was in this weird Nintendo Giga Leak of all things, and here it is, and to send it to him. And yeah, it did make me really happy to be able to do that for him after all the help he'd given me. It seemed to make him quite happy to have this work back that he never thought he would have before. And, you know, I guess there is a lot of ethically questionable aspects to the whole GigaLeak story, but that was something where it was a nice moment where I was able to reunite someone with their work from years ago.
Yeah, I think that's something that can get lost sometimes in video game preservation is, of course, it's super nice to see things in action again. But the other part of it is like real people worked on this and were probably proud of it and enjoyed it. And to be able to reunite them with that is pretty cool, too.
Right. Yeah, certainly.
So yeah, what is the plan with the Workboy prototype, if I may ask after this? Is this going back to Frank Ballou, or is this, do you still have it
in the Liam Museum?
Yeah.
All right. So I've just launched an eBay auction. Not really. I am planning on sending it back to Frank. I've not spoken to him recently. I think he's quite a busy guy, as I mentioned. My plan is to do a couple of like follow-up videos and then send it back to him. And I would encourage Frank, hey, send this to a museum, you know, like who knows what will happen as the years go by. Maybe something happens to it. Maybe something happens to you. I would like Frank to put it, you know, give it to the right people, like people like yourselves. I wouldn't know what to do with it myself. People have told me, hey, do a teardown and, you know, try to recreate it and 3D print it and stuff. And I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing on that level.
Also, no one needs this. Come on. No one needs to have a bootleg work boy. That's not going to enhance anyone's life.
Well, there are quite a few people who would disagree with you based upon some of the comments I've gotten. But anyway,
I can't have a work boy in my hands. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself.
Yeah. So my plan right now is I want to do a couple of follow-up videos and show some of the different functions that I didn't get to show in the video that I've done already. And one thing that I want to show, for instance, because there's been a lot of requests, is there is a function in the Workboy where you can look at a world map and you can play different sort of 8-bit national anthems of various countries. And I've had some requests like, hey, can you play this country's national anthem? And I don't think there's that many national anthems in the Workboy, but I would like to just do a compilation video. You know, here's the USA, here's Canada, whatever. That's something that I definitely want to do. And just do a little, a walkthrough of the Workboy. I have filmed some stuff already, but that'll be something I'll do. And then I would like to get it back to Frank and encourage him, hey, why don't you send it to these people and then they can preserve it and people can see it and it will be remembered. But it's not mine. It's up to him. I think the right thing to do is to send it back to him and send him a copy of the software so he can use it if he wants to. If I don't know, maybe he still has productivity needs that need fulfilling by the Workboy. I don't know.
I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you, Liam, but we actually featured the Workboy in a museum exhibit that we put together.
Yeah, you did mention that. You built a prototype out of cardboard, didn't you?
I did. I built a papercraft Workboy. So we were.
It was pretty cute.
It from a distance, it actually looked pretty good. The previous three Portland Retro Gaming Expos, we sort of sponsored the museum in that we, you know, hosted it and put it together and stuff like that. And last year, well, not last year, 2019, was a Game Boy specific exhibit. And, you know, we didn't want to just put out a bunch of Game Boy stuff and be like, ta-da, there it is. You know, we like to say something, you know? And so we sort of had different concepts around the Game Boy, things like, you know, how it was sold around the world, the sort of primitive origins of it, things like that. And one thing we wanted to demonstrate was how the Game Boy itself was used as essentially a microcomputer for other purposes. So we had the fishing sonar and
the sewing machine,
right. And we did. This is when we contacted Frank just to be like, "Hey, can we borrow a work boy if you've got one?" Because we think it'd be really nice in this exhibit. But yeah, we ended up building a papercraft work boy, and I set it up, you know, with the Game Boy sort of the way it was in the PR photos. And the papercraft work boy is now in the possession of a Game Boy collector who collects accessories, who contributed to the museum himself and was really happy to take home the closest thing there was until now to there being a work boy.
That's great. Yeah. Not that I would ever sell it, but a part of me is curious, you know, what is the value of something like this and how would that be determined, given that there might only be this one prototype left. Eddie Gale reckons there might be one at Nintendo, but it is extremely rare.
That one's not leaving.
yeah, I don't think so. Unless, you know, the Nintendo hackers want to take it to the next level and do some kind of Ocean's 11 type shit. I don't know. But I just want to see it safe. You know, I want to see it given to someone who can look after it and preserve what they can of it. I don't know what really is left to be done with it, but I people have talked about, you know, maybe you can clone it. I don't know, but I would just like to find it the right home, because, you know, humans have an expiration date, and I would like it to live on beyond us. I know that's a bit of a weird thing to say, but there you go.
Yeah, so yeah, we've never said anything like that around here. Yeah.
Video game history lives and dies with us. That's the end.
There's actually like a switch inside of me. When my heart stops, the whole archive burns. So. I'm trying to figure out how to word this, but I mean, what's the sort of legacy of the work boy? Is there a reason to care about its place in history, or is it just kind of an interesting little side story?
I think it certainly does have its place in history when you look at the trajectory beyond it when it comes to PDAs and smartphones and what have you. This was developed by Eddie Gale, someone who I consider a pioneer, who went on to be instrumental in designing what would go on to become the modern smartphone. And even if you just look at the UI of the work boy, the home screen is eerily similar to what you have on like an iPhone or something. You know, it's so far ahead of its time in many respects. And that's not to say necessarily that the work boy inspired the iPhone or whatever, but I just think it does have its place. You know, it was a stepping stone, I think, in the history of these devices, of productivity-related devices. And, you know, the fact that it went on to inspire the Nokia 9000 and many of the ideas Eddie had for the work boy lived on in that. Yeah, I do think there is some importance to it, even though we look back on it now, and it is more, I guess, a novel curiosity of the era that it was built on that not many people know about. But yeah, I do think it does have its place in history, and it does have a degree of worth, I would say, creatively.
For me, I think it just shows an interesting stumbling block, maybe toward the inevitability of smartphones, but really toward the merging of computers and dedicated video game consoles. We don't use video game consoles for productivity, but we use them now for non-gaming entertainment. And I think I view it more as just a stepping stone toward that. But maybe the smartphone is the better link. I don't know. I want things to be about video game history, not smartphone.
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I think that society was, you know, technology in general was trending towards what became the smartphone, and it found different applications, you know, before it became a smartphone. And one of those was, you know, use the $80 computer you already had in your pocket.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose really, you know, the smartphone itself, it's like, well, you are, again, you have a computer in your pocket. We might as well add on these other things, but you can just do those as apps now, as opposed to selling a cartridge and a keyboard accessory.
I think it is also indicative of a time when video games try to, I think, you know, pretend that they were more useful than they actually were. You know, they were trying to appeal to adults and to say, look, this isn't just a device for little kids. This is something that the grown-ups can also enjoy. You know, it was from a time when games were still trying to justify their existence to the mainstream and not just be these useless nerds toys for little babies. I definitely think there's something to be said for that.
And you had a lot of that with the Game Boy too, even outside of the Work Boy. I mean, there is the Bible on the Game Boy, the King James Bible on the Game Boy. There's all kinds of just, there is, there's all kinds of just random, like, I'm blanking on the publisher of those games.
I think it was the InfoGenius.
I think InfoGenius. And they had a whole line of basically just broken out functions of the Work Boy almost. It was, you know, travel guides and dictionaries, you know, Spanish to English, English to Spanish type things. So, I mean, the Game Boy had a lot of that going on, which I think is, you know, both that sort of video games proving themselves and also the fact that it's portable. It's a very easy to carry around little device, easy to kind of tack on other, you know, try other things, tack on other things to this thing that you're already carrying.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Liam, thank you so much for joining us on the Video Game History Hour. Where can people find you and your videos on the internet?
My videos are in a series called Game History Secrets, which you can find on the Did You Know Gaming channel. Or you just go on YouTube, type in Game History Secrets, and I do other such videos like this where I look into video game history, obscure stories, generally console games that I feel like there hasn't been enough research done into. But yeah, I also have a Twitter where you can find me. I'm at Dr_Cupcakes. Don't know why, just am. And but yeah, follow that if you like what I have to say. If you do, I don't know.
Well, thank you so much, Liam. And I'm sure this won't be the last time our listeners hear from you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been really fun.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter, @GameHistoryHour, or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunamune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.